I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
Sex, drugs, rock and roll, and big hairdos. Glam metal took LA's Sunset Strip and the world by storm in the 1980s with bands like Motley Crue, Quiet Riot, Dawkins, and Twisted Sister. And now it appears that glam metal is experiencing its own nostalgia chic moment, thanks to Netflix's Motley Crue biopic, The Dirt. But The Dirt, along with most other lurid accounts of rock and roll debauchery along the Sunset Strip in the 80s and 90s, only gives one side of the story, namely that of the guys. That's right, what about the perspective of the ladies? Joining us on this edition of Parallax Views, to give a feminine take on living the rock and roll lifestyle, is the video vixen that single-handedly activated millions of teenage libidos in the Warrant music video, Cherry Pie, Bobby Brown. It's a candid conversation with the it girl of the 90s Sunset Strip, who's gone on to star in the hit reality TV series Ex-Wives of Rock and authored the explosive tell-all memoir Dirty Rocker Boys, Love and Lust on the Sunset Strip. From her humble beginnings in Louisiana to her rise to stardom in Los Angeles, Bobby Brown fills us in on her career in modeling, her famous and often rocky relationships with Warrant's Janie Lane and Motley Crue's Tommy Lee, the latter of whom controversially broke it off with Bobby to get with Pamela Anderson. Have to say, he made a mistake there, because Bobby really is sweet as cherry pie. Unlike a great many who have had a taste of fame, Bobby remains an incredibly down-to-earth gal with no inclinations of being a diva, as evidenced by how gracious she was with her time and willing to open up about anything, including her former interest in the occult, how she overcame her struggles with addiction, her thoughts on the Me Too movement, and her take on the aforementioned Netflix Motley Crue biopic, The Dirt, as well as her recent venture into the world of stand-up comedy. Hell, we even talk about the trials and tribulations of online dating. All that and more in my conversation with the Cherry Pie Girl herself, Bobby Brown. Welcome to Parallax Views, Bobby Brown.
Hi.
Bobby, I wanted to have you on the show because, you know, we have this new movie out on Netflix that's taking the world by storm, The Dirt, which is about Motley Crue. But I actually liked your book better, Dirty Rocker Boys. You're, of course, very well known for being the cherry pie girl in Warren's cherry pie video, and you later dated Tommy Lee from Motley Crue. The book, though, it's really amazing to me because it's not just some story of, you know, the wildness of glam hair metal on the Sunset Strip. It's sort of like an Alice in Wonderland down the rabbit hole through the looking glass type story, in the sense that you're like a fish out of water when you first go to the Sunset Strip. Maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about growing up in Louisiana and just what that was like and how it differed from the image that people have of you from maybe the rock music world.
Okay. Well, there's a lot to touch on there. Let's see. Well, I'm going to start by saying The Dirt, yes, just came out. And I have a podcast called Bobby and Cherise Podcast.com where she and I just talk the true dirt, if you want to say. And I think that my book, Dirty Rocker Boys, I'm so glad that you enjoyed it. And, it's very funny that you said going down the rabbit hole. I've never really heard it put that way, but, it totally applies. And I would love to make that a movie too, because I think it would be great. And Baton Rouge to LA is like night and day. I mean, I didn't even know what I was getting into when I came here, but that's what I, you know, grew up thinking I was going to do, be a model, move to LA or to New York and try to pursue that. And, I came here and it was definitely a sight, and I had a lot of, growing up and learning to do, mostly by making a bunch of mistakes.
Well, you know, I hope, listeners get my Alice in Wonderland, type reference there, because to me, it's like Alice in Wonderland with a lot more debauchery, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, that totally applies. Yes. 100%. I mean, I just graduated high school and won, Miss, you know, Teen Louisiana. I was a Miss Teen USA and, you know, was the top five runner ups. And they asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, I wanted to model in LA. And that's when I got phone calls to come out here. So I did. And I mean, it was a shock to the system, you know, a Southern girl to the LA debauchery. 100%. I mean, everybody's here to make it or in the entertainment industry. I'm a very trusting person. I'm still a very trusting person, unfortunately, but people out here are opportunist and definitely competitive, and it's a hard life, you know? A lot to learn when you come out here, for sure.
Well, so growing up in Louisiana, you're not exactly the girl that was into glam metal and you know, stuff like that back then. What was it like for you growing up? It's very different from who you became later on.
Right. I had just started liking Motley Crue like right before I moved out, because that's when MTV got really, you know, was all the rage. And they were on it all the time. And I just thought it was so cool that these guys wore makeup, you know? And it was crazy to me. There were no guys like that in Louisiana, for sure. And I grew up listening to, like, my dad did country and, soul music and, you know, pop or whatever, but never really rock. Rock wasn't like a thing, in Louisiana. So like when I came out here and, you know, saw these guys that looked like women and had makeup on and, it was crazy. And I started, you know, got with an agency and started modeling and immediately started doing rock videos, because that was, like I said, MTV was like, you know, at its hugest back then. And it was all about the, you know, the music video.
The thing I found interesting, I guess, was that you were sort of into the hip hop scene originally.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I still like to dance to hip hop music. Like that's, you know, if I'm listening to anything on the radio, it's like pop or hip hop for sure.
Out of curiosity, how did LA sort of, how did they initially catch your eye, the modeling agencies? I guess you were involved in Miss Louisiana Teen USA. Could you tell my listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was I was in a pageant in Louisiana and won Miss Teen Louisiana and then was in Miss Teen USA and I got the top five. And my question was, what do you want to be? You know, look, what do you want to do with your life? And I said, I want to model in LA. And then that I got some calls from, you know, people interested. And then I moved out here when I graduated high school, like right when I graduated, signed with an agency. And that's what I pursued. And that's how I got any of my jobs, you know, was through that Star Search and any rock videos and whatnot was through my modeling agency. But I was lucky enough to get signed with an agency when I came out here.
What was your experience like with Star Search? Because that was sort of, you know, in a lot of ways, that's a centerpiece to the book. It sort of starts a lot of threads in your story. And you, of course, you know, I guess won it 13 times, right? Like you broke a record.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It was very cool. I mean, it started off just like a job, you know, like my agency asked if I would be interested in doing it. And I was like, okay. So, it was kind of just like a modeling job, but then, you know, the more I won, the more I was there for like a year filming and shooting and the show would air and we'd be doing another one. And, so, I mean, those people kind of became like, you know, my family or like a regular job, you know what I mean? And that's pretty much what catapulted me into any type of career or position of people recognizing me or any stardom whatsoever because of being on that show every week, you know? And then they had reruns, you know, that summer when everybody was on hiatus. So like, you know, I was on TV for a year straight.
And I guess, it's interesting the story you tell with regards to how you started out getting into modeling. I guess for you, it wasn't necessarily something that you thought, well, I have to win. I have to, you know, it wasn't like a super competition for you. You were like, if I do well, you know, that's great. If I don't, I have other avenues I can explore. Could you sort [S2] Right. [S1] Of tell me how that affected how that outlook maybe affected your experience when you got to the Sunset Strip?
Well, I probably should, you know, I think maybe that was just my way of setting myself up for possibility of failure or disappointment. Who knows? I'm not a very competitive person at all, which is uncanny because of where I live, but I never really have been. So, and probably if I had, I'd probably succeeded much more or faster than I, you know, ever did. It wasn't really my dream. It was more my mom's dream kind of. So I just kind of went with, you know, kind of rolled with the punches in a way. And anytime anything got too scary or whatever, I would usually sabotage it. But this, was just something, like I said, was just like another job and it was exciting that I kept winning. It was like flattering, but I wasn't really, I hadn't really caught on to feeling myself yet, if that makes any sense. And so I didn't really realize that it mattered to me until I lost. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's when it hit me. I was like, oh shit, you know? But then, you know, you have to pick up the pieces and move on. But it wasn't until that moment that I realized that it mattered to me, you know?
Did you sort of feel that, like, when you lost the first time, were you like, was it sort of a panicky moment? Like, oh, well, what do I do from here? You know?
Kind of in a way. I mean, you know, back, that was before a lot of competition shows were really on TV and you know how they have like American Idol and it's like, it's best not to be the winner. You know what I mean? Because you know, the winner never does anything and it's always the runner ups that have the record deals and whatever. Nobody tells you that back then. So back then I'm thinking like, oh man, maybe I just, you know, blew it or whatever. Plus Ed McMahon started to say my name first. So I kind of stood there stunned, like, wait, what? Cause I think he assumed before even looking at the paper that it was going to be me cause I'd won more than anybody so far. And then when he looked down, it was the other girl's name. He was like, oh, you know, and then so it kind of threw me. And then I just went back to my room and just kind of cried and was like, what the hell? But like I said, it did end up serving me obviously because like I was on TV, like I said, for a year straight and then in reruns. So, you know, there were a lot of unhappy fans at that point that I actually lost.
I'm just curious, what is your sort of perspective on modeling? Because I think there's a lot of people that say, oh, it's real easy, you just have to look pretty. And then I think there's other people that would say, there's a lot that goes into it, how you carry yourself and whatnot. What's your sort of perspective on what goes into it?
Yeah, I disagree on the whole, whoever said it was easy. It's definitely not easy. I mean, I guess compared to a hard labor job or somebody who was getting paid minimum wage to, you know, sit and do something that they hated. This, on the other hand, you would think would be, you know, an easy job or whatever. It's easy to take a photograph, sure, but it is about posing and it is about, you know, being touched 800 times in between each shot and, you know, because your hair has to be just right or your makeup or they want you in this position or you have to be in freezing cold water all day long or you have to pose with somebody who's an asshole or, you know, whatever. And it's a long, long day. It's a lot of hurry and waiting. And it's a lot of discomfort. You know what I mean? Like you have to wear shoes that are too small for you because the wardrobe person didn't get the right size. But people go like, oh, boo hoo. Oh, that sounds so sad. You know, you had to stand there and look pretty all day and get paid, you know, $5,000. I get where the perspective is where people wouldn't understand that theory. But on the other hand, it's like, you know, it's tedious and annoying and can be. And there's a lot of other elements that go into making it not glamorous, you know?
Well, I was going to mention, in preparation for this conversation we're having right now, I was watching your reality show, Ex-Wives of Rock. And Athena's daughter, Toby, started to do modeling. And there's one episode where I guess she was doing a shoot for Playboy, and you could tell she was just like very uncomfortable. And a lot of that may have been due to Athena pushing her a little bit harder. But there's a lot that goes into it psychologically, I think, too. And you sort of see that in that episode.
Yeah, 100%. Well, plus that was also she was going to be nude. So that's a whole nother, you know, stress barrier there. But yeah, there is a lot, you know, it's a lot of, you know, a lot of traveling, a lot of, inconsistency with, you know, work and, competitiveness with other women. And just, it's a lot to deal with mentally sometimes too, because it's all about how you look, you know, and people age and people, you know, have a new in thing. And like, it's just, you know, it kind of messes with your head eventually because it's not about, you know, who you are and how smart you are or what you have to contribute. It's about how you look. And that kind of can mess with your head sometimes.
Yeah. And I think that also applies to maybe the culture shock that you mentioned earlier that you experienced when you first came to the Sunset Strip. What was that sort of like? What was the Sunset Strip like when you went there? Was it as debauched as people imagine it?
Yes, 100%. Totally. And it's just, you know, and back then everybody, you know, dressed like whores and, you know, everybody was scantily clad. And so, you know, you constantly are under pressure to be thin and to be attractive and to have perfect hair, teeth, what, you know, clothing, what you drive. You know, what you do, like, it's just, it's a whole thing out here, especially, you know?
Yeah. And it's interesting because I guess when you went there, immediately, at least from what you say in the book, you sort of immediately fit in a lot of ways, or at least are able to get into the clubs and sort of mingle with, the parade of Hollywood celebrities and stars. Maybe you could, tell listeners a little bit what that experience was like, maybe without giving away too much. I want my listeners to read the book.
Yeah. When I was in Louisiana, I was one person. And when I came out here, I decided I was going to be another person. I was going to be a confident person, a person who didn't give a shit. I mean, and it's kind of like you have to do that because when you do care, they can smell you coming from a mile away. Nobody is into anybody who lacks confidence or is insecure or needs the job. You know what I mean? So you have to kind of teach yourself to like fit in with everybody or else they're going to eat you alive. So, so immediately, you know, when the clubs were happening or whatever, I would just prance my ass to the front of the line and expect to get in. You know what I mean? Which sounds very entitled, but here you kind of have to do that or else you become ignored. You don't get to get in and you're waiting for hours. And, you know, back then I was so overconfident anyway. You know, I hadn't lived any life yet, so I just didn't expect anything but, and it worked.
Yeah. And it's, I don't know. Some of the, stories of how you handled the, celebrities when you first got there, I found pretty amusing. There's some amusing anecdotes about, O.J. Simpson. And, my favorite line, I have to say the line was, you walk into the club and you said, Scott Baio was staring at my ass like it was his long lost puppy.
Puppy. Yeah. It was pretty crazy. I mean, everybody was there at Helena's. That was like the end club. But like I said, I just acted like I belonged there. And, you know, and when you're new in town and like new prey, you know, everybody's like trying to, you know, scope you out.
So out of curiosity, well, first, I want to say for my listeners that may not be familiar, Helena's was a private supper club. It was run by, I believe, a famous character actress, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Well, I wanted to get into, like, how you became involved with the sort of glam or, I guess, hair metal scene. How does that sort of start? Like, how did the rocker boys find you?
Well, like I said, it was with my agency, and there was a call for rock videos all the time. And, you know, whatever they were specifically looking for, if I fit that bill, I would go in for the casting and audition. And that was a huge thing back then, was MTV, like I said, with the rock videos and music videos. So I got sent on quite a few, you know, interviews for MTV and rock videos. So the first one I did was Hurricane, and then I did Hurricane, and then I did Great White, Once Bitten, Twice Shy, and then I believe Janie saw me on Star Search, and I did Cherry Pie, or was that after? Maybe it was Cherry Pie. I did a few before Cherry Pie, actually. Let me think. So it was Cherry Pie, I did Terrence Tritt D'Arby, Great White, and Times Two. They were like a one-hit wonder band. And I think that's it. And Hurricane. And then I think Cherry Pie was actually the last video I did.
Well, I wanted to get to that. So what was it like on the set of that iconic video? Did you guys expect for it to... I'm just going to say it bluntly. I think that music video single-handedly, you know, activated the libidos of thousands of teenage male boys.
Yeah, I get that a lot. That's so funny. First of all, when I shot the video, it was a 3-day shoot in Hollywood in a soundstage in Hollywood. And I didn't get along with the director. He was a misogynist asshole. But Janie and, you know, the rest of the band were, you know, very welcoming and nice and accommodating and whatever. And he sent me flowers to the set. And it was 3 very long days. And a lot of scenes that I didn't want to do or fought about not doing. But it was a lot of fun. And that's pretty much it. Is that what you asked me? What else did you ask me?
I was just curious what it was like on set. Was there anything that you ended up not doing or you said, I can't do that?
Oh, yeah. Like they wanted me to get in a tub of whipped cream, like naked. And I was like, not doing that. And then the hose scene, they did it once. And I was like, I hope you got that shot because I'm not doing that again. That was brutal. That was like, because it was a real fire hose and the water to my face. Literally, I felt like my face was peeling off.
Wow.
Yeah, it was not cool. So I was like, not doing that shot again. I hope you got it.
Right off the bat, you hit it off with, you know, I want to say that he's equal parts tragic and brilliant. Janie Lane. Do you hit it off like right there, off the bat with the Cherry Pie video?
Yeah, well, we hit it off when I interviewed for the actual job. But he was rather shy and stuff, and I was just, you know, goofy and myself and whatever. But he was, I guess he had developed a crush on me. I didn't even know it. But yeah, I totally have never felt awkward or weird around anybody. Like I said, like I felt like everybody is equal. I don't care what they do for a living, whether they're a celebrity or not. I treat everybody the same. And so he was, you know, very cool, and he was rather shy but nice, you know.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because when I first saw the Ex-Wives of Rock, the first episode, they sort of say they use that line where you call him a dork, and then they have an image of him getting kicked out. But you actually seem to have a lot of sympathy for Janie in spite of everything with regards to your relationship with him.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot about him I didn't know when we were married, because we were both very young. And I mean, I got married when I was 21, so that's pretty young, and had my daughter. We had a lot of growing up to do, so there was a lot like about him I hadn't learned to know yet when we divorced 3 years later. So it wasn't until many years later that I, you know, actually got to know him, respect him as a person, and, you know, because we have a daughter together. So, you know, I mean, we fought, we didn't, we, you know, we were friends, we weren't, like, it went through the motions, you know, obviously. But he was a good guy. He had a lot that he suppressed, a lot of emotional things that had happened to him growing up and as a teenager that were pretty hectic and stuff that he just didn't want to feel. So this is why, you know, he slowly but surely became such the alcoholic that he did, you know, embarrassing things that, you know, nobody wants to have to feel or relive or think about or, you know, imagine happening to them. And so, you know, he had a lot of pain that he dealt with that I never knew about when we were married.
I think, though, that you give a fuller picture of him. I like some of the anecdotes you have about how he first tried to woo you. I think he said, I think it was, he was in this story where he said he wanted to sleep on the floor just so he could
Tommy.
Smell you. Oh, that was Tommy. Okay.
That was Tommy. Yeah. Tommy said he wanted to breathe my air. Yeah. Wanted to be in the same room so he could breathe my air. Okay, buddy. Janie was, he went on Howard Stern and professed his love to me, and he was a dork. He was like, he would do impressions or try to like be cool and say something cool, like when our daughter was growing up or whatever. And he was such a dork, you know what I mean? But in a good way. I don't mean it like bad. I mean, I'm a dork, you know what I mean? So, you know, because when I said that, people were like, that's so rude. I'm like, why? It was true. Like, he would, you know, show us how to do strip pole dances, like a stripper. And we'd be like so embarrassed, like, oh, my God. You know, he was always trying to be funny. Yeah, he was always trying to be funny. But sometimes it was like, holy shit, that was embarrassing. You know what I mean? but he was a good guy. Like, he had a good heart. Like, he meant well. He just had a lot of fucked up shit going on in his life. Mm-hmm. That I didn't know about. Am I allowed to cuss? I'm sorry.
Yeah, no problem, no problem.
Oh, okay.
You know, one of the other things I found interesting, and then we'll start moving on maybe to some of the other rocker boys, was just the, you said that he doesn't get enough credit for what he actually did with the band Warrant. I've heard a lot of people say that. It sounds like he contributed much more to that band and didn't even take personal credit for it.
Right. He would write all the songs. He would write the entire album and even like lay out the parts for the other guys. And if the other guys couldn't play the part, they would hire somebody to play the part and they would learn the part. But he would write he did the entire process. You know, he would write all the songs and then, you know, rehearse with them and, you know, lay out their parts for them. So, and then he even gave them a percentage of royalties, even though that's just unheard of. He, you know, cause that, those were his dudes. So, generously he gave them a percentage of royalties when really he did all of the work.
Well, so Janie was sort of the first rocker boy that I guess, was really one of your most famous relationships. The other one, of course, is Tommy Lee, which we sort of mentioned that earlier when I was mixing the two up. What was Tommy Lee like? It sounds like he could be a bit of a man-child.
He is 100% that in a nutshell, yes. Very entitled and spoiled and bratty, and in the way that he, you know, he's wants his way and has to have his way and has to have it right now, like, kind of thing. But I mean, he grew up as a teenager in Motley Crue, like, and becoming a man. So basically, from the time he wasn't even a graduate from high school, he was, you know, a millionaire and a rock star and getting everything he wants from anybody he wants all the time. And so I guess he never really had to grow up in a way, you know, so maybe that's to his, you know, to his excuse or whatever. But he literally, you know, never knew a hard day's work or whatever, you know, nobody ever told him no.
It reminds me a lot of, I always hear this about pro wrestlers and rock stars, is that they're like, it's like they never left high school. They, when they get into like pro wrestling or rock and roll, or even just maybe a lot of sectors of the entertainment industry, a lot of it's like, you know, they still have that high school boy mentality about things.
Yeah, I just feel like exactly that. When, you know, when somebody, first of all, when somebody, you know, demands that much attention or needs that much attention from everybody at all times, I mean, that's a lot to have to deal with and accept in a person. And, you know, depending on if you're the flavor or not, you know, your fame rises and falls many times, depending. And, you know, they go through this, you know, withdrawal, rejection, having to screw the whole world to prove their ego, or, you know what I mean? Like, who do they trust? Do people like me for who I am, or because I'm famous and a rock star or have money? Like, it's a whole trust thing with people. And then they want to control you because, you know, like I said, they're used to getting their way and needing all this attention. They're a lot of work, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you think there's a certain, I don't know how to put this, like a certain personality type, like that's very, how do I put it? Like insecure, that may get driven to wanting to be in, you know, rock and roll, to be a rock star.
Oh, hell yeah. Totally. Absolutely. Maybe, you know, they grew up and were mistreated or abused or fat or, you know, the nerd, who knows, you know, kids can be cruel, but I mean, yeah, it usually is. I mean, I've never known anybody who grew up having everything, like, and getting everything they wanted, have the desire to be a rock star. I don't know. It just so happens to have worked out that way, but I mean, I could be wrong, but that's how it looks to me anyway.
Well, you know, the Tommy Lee aspect of the book is really, to me, it's like one of the most surreal aspects of it, because early on in the book, you're talking about how you had Tommy Lee posters and you loved that there was this new masculinity of guys that were so masculine that they could wear makeup and have long hair and get away with it. And you're just thinking about marrying Tommy Lee one day. And then it actually happens.
Yeah.
You can tell my listeners just about that surreal moment when you actually hook up with Tommy Lee.
Yeah. I used to have this thing. It was really weird. Like, I guess I used to manifest things and I didn't even know I was doing it. Like, I used to say something, I would say I wanted something or visualize it or imagine it or whatever. And it would always happen. And I never realized until later when I started doing it with negative things that I had that kind of control over, you know, certain aspects of what happened in my life. And, but yeah, definitely. I mean, I grew up saying, you know, I wanted to be with Tommy Lee and, lose my virginity to him and stupid shit like that. And then there I was, you know, looking for houses and engaged to him years later. Yeah, so that's kind of crazy, but I stopped doing that when it came to negative stuff because it got scary, but, yeah, it's true. It kind of all just fell into place weirdly.
Well, I wanted to ask about, you're sort of talking about when you said that negative stuff, I know, you grew up in Louisiana. So, I guess you're familiar with stuff like voodoo and, you know, even New Age stuff you mentioned in the book. Some of my listeners are interested in that kind of thing. You know, cue the X-Files theme, right? What do you make of all that kind of stuff?
It's real. It's totally real. I know people go like, oh, give me a break. Like my own brother is all like, oh, stop talking about that kind of stuff. But let me tell you something. I don't mess with it anymore because of the fact that it is real. And I used to be convinced that it can't, you know, if you did it for good and like if you were involved and, you know, only did things for the good of everybody involved, it's fine. But really it's derivative of a negative energy. And regardless of what you think it is, it really is. And, it doesn't end up working out for you in the ways that you hope it will. So I stopped messing with that, but yeah, I used to do that kind of stuff and, it's not good, not good to mess around with. So I wouldn't suggest anybody getting involved doing it.
Well, you heard it here first. Bobby Brown says, don't get involved with that bad juju.
Cause you know, you always end up paying the price for it some way or another when you do that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting. I think, you know, maybe tampering with that negative energy, maybe that came out of something else. It sounds like, I mean, to speak plainly, you know, dating rocker boys is also like dating heartbreakers. Maybe you could talk about, what do you think it is about rockers that you know, they just end up being the bad boy heartbreakers?
Like I said, when you are in need of that much constant attention from everyone and females and whatever and used to getting it, it's like no matter what you're feeling, that becomes, it would become for them, you know, an ego boost, like, oh, I'm gonna get laid by the, how many people can I screw, I mean, and plus the women are throwing themselves at them constantly, so it's like, you know, you can be confident as the day is long, and I was, but you know, to have to constantly compete with the fact that, you know, you can't watch them 24/7. You have to have some sort of trust in your relationship. But really, I mean, who's to say that if I wasn't a rock star and I had, you know, that much, you know, ass offered to me all day long, I would say no. You know what I mean? You never know. Like, I don't know. But I'm a female, so that's different. But I mean, men are, you know, usually just all about wanting to have sex with people. And if it's that easy, if it comes that easy, like, well, are they going to say no? You know what I mean? So you have to remember, like, that's hard to, if you can handle that kind of shit, then go for it. But it's very hard. And 90% of the time they don't reject it, you know?
Well, I mean, it's almost like a hall of mirrors. I love the story of how you met, Charisse, one of your best friends. Maybe you can tell my listeners about that because it sort of illustrates how rockers can be at times.
Yeah. So Vince was new on his solo venture and he was performing at Spice one night. It was a club in LA and I had seen Charisse on one of their videos and thought, you know, she was really pretty and whatever. I knew he was married and I'm there and I see her on the side of the stage because Vince is about to perform. And then Vince comes around the corner with his, you know, his entourage and literally walks straight up to me and hit on me. And she was in the room and I was like, wow. I said, no, thanks. I mean, he knew I was married. I invited them to our wedding because Janie had opened for Molly. So they were on our invite list for our wedding. So he knew I was married. He was married. His wife was there. My husband was out of town, but literally came up to me and hit on me and I declined and turned and walked straight towards Charisse just to freak him out, you know, like, cause I was so appalled and introduced myself and he came following behind just like, oh shit, what is she doing? I didn't say anything to her in that moment, but I, you know, became friends with her after that.
Well, yeah, and I think that illustrates that heartbreaker sort of way that a lot of rockers have. And one of the threads in your book is that early on you're sort of told by various people in Hollywood that, you know, Hollywood has this weird way of changing people and, you know, in a negative way. What was the point at which, you know, you felt yourself sort of starting to change and, you know, maybe seeking out a little bit of revenge?
Probably after, you know, being here for a while, realizing what it really is and who are your friends and who aren't, and so many who turn out not to be, and the experiences that I've had and the constant rejection or the constant trying to fit in or get the part or, you know, be the A-list and, you know, whatever. It's just never ending here. And you never know who you can depend on. Like if you have a moment and, you know, you don't have family here, it's like, who can you lean on that's not going to literally rob from you or try and screw your boyfriend or get your job or talk shit about you behind your back? Or, you know, it's like, who's legit? And it turns out to be, you know, a lot more than not that you, a lot that you don't have thinking that you do, and you get screwed over a lot. So it's like, you know, you end up feeling alone a lot here, realizing what people's intentions truly are, you know?
Yeah. You know, there's one of my favorite poets, LA's own Charles Bukowski, had a line, being alone with the crowd, you know, I imagine that's how it can feel sometimes.
Yeah, totally. I mean, 100%. You can be in a room full of people and feel totally alone or more alone than ever, even. Because every, you know, it's so fake and so frivolous, and you're in one day, you're out the next. Like, it's just, it's really a hard pill to swallow. And, you know, I have a lot of regret from, you know, prioritizing that as my life instead of being the mom I wanted to be, or, you know, doing the right thing. Like at the end of the day, the entertainment industry isn't going to be here for you. And I missed a lot of my daughter's life growing up, focusing on trying to be relevant and, you know, make it in this town. And I missed the most important stuff, you know, and you don't realize that until it's too late, you know, and this town isn't going to be here for you. This town isn't going to hold your hand or be there for you if you have an accident or go broke or, you know what I mean? It's like, it was a waste of time and energy, and maybe it's fulfilling to some people. I just don't think it is. As you can see, to a lot of people, it ends up not being. So can do a lot more harm than it does good sometimes.
Well, you know, if this is going in a direction that you're uncomfortable with, let me know.
No, I'm fine.
I wanted to ask about, you've had a lot of, you've gone through sort of a recovery. I mean, you've had your heart broken by some of these rockers. You broke some hearts along the way. I think MSN, said that you were one of the top heartbreakers of rock stars.
yeah.
Well, I was also going to say, I think you've gone through things with drugs and even mental health. I just wanted to ask, how did you sort of push through that? Because I have a lot of listeners that deal with things. They ask me questions about, you know, life advice and whatnot. Maybe you could tell us how you were sort of able to power through the, you know, the muck and the difficulties.
Well, I had to, you know, I sought therapy, which was very helpful, and the strength and support of my family and close friends. You know, you have to weed out, you know, you have to start putting people in categories. They're that kind of friend, or they're that kind of person. Like, can you rely on them at 2 a.m? No. Okay. So they're in that category. Like, your friends and people, you know, become, you know, categories, and, you really have to, you know, go back to what you know, and that's, you know, the love of your family and friends. And if you don't have that, then you need to seek therapy, and, you know, get yourself straight and figured out, because if you don't know who you are and what your purpose is and what you're meant to do or how you're going to pull out of the pain that you're feeling, then, you know, it's going to be bad, and it doesn't get better, you know, alone, especially here.
What I also wanted to say, I hope I didn't I hope that didn't come off as disrespectful, what no. I said about, you know, MSN, saying that you were one of the heartbreakers of rock and roll. How do you feel about that, that sort of, interpretation of you?
That's funny. I think it's funny. I was heavily sought after in my youth, you know, everybody wants a piece of the, you know, the new hot girl that's in LA or whatever. And it's flattering to an extent, but the reality is, you know, so a lot of times when people got to know me as a person, they wanted the, you know, the video vixen. And I was, I was not that person. I was very loving and sensitive and put your toothpaste on your toothbrush. And people were like, whoa, where's that, where's the hot babe that, you know, like, you know what I mean? Like they couldn't separate the person they thought I was compared to the actual person, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting to me because what really shines through in the book, I think, is this desire to really form strong relationships, especially right. with men on the Sunset Strip. But it seems like you just keep coming up against, you know, a wall each and every time.
Right. Well, definitely trying to date a rock star is going to be difficult if that's your goal. And that obviously was mine. And that was never going to happen. because they're just not capable. Maybe if they're older, maybe so, but like, you know, back then, never. And, you know, a lot of times just people in the entertainment industry, period. Like I got to a point where I was like, I refuse to date an actor, you know, because they're so full of themselves and so egotistical and entitled and just, you know, with fame comes a lot of head tripping and, you know, you never really know what you're getting.
Was there anyone on the Sunset Strip, any guys that didn't fit the sort of, I don't know, I'm going to say it, the douche parade profile, as you put it in the book.
That was a rock star or famous?
Yeah, I'm just curious.
God. maybe not. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure if I thought about it, there's a few people that are famous that are actually really cool and down to earth. But none are coming to my head right now. There was one person that his wife, I did a TV series and he used to be on Saturday Night Live and his wife shot and killed him. He was on a series with me that I was on with Andy Dick. It was what was that TV show with Andy Dick and David Foley and do you know who I'm talking about?
I'm trying to think of it.
Something about, it was like a radio station.
News radio. Joe Rogan used to be on that show. Now he's like a famous internet celebrity.
Exactly. He was on that show. Who was the guy that played he was on SNL. He was a famous comedian and his wife shot and killed him. John, what was his name? John? Anyway, he was actually very cool and down to earth and super chill and awesome and nice. The guy that played Al Bundy was very cool on Married with Children. And so was the woman who played the wife, Katie.
Oh, Katie Sagal.
Yeah, she's awesome. She was very cool. Yeah, I mean, there was some people along the way that was actually really, really like nice and chill.
Slash comes off as like the coolest person in rock and roll in your book, I have to say.
Slash was very cool to me back then. I mean, I haven't seen him in years or talked to him in years, and I can't, you know, speak about him now. But back then, he was very cool. Duff was actually really cool to me back then, and down to earth and chill, and we had fun. Dave Navarro, awesome, love him. We had the best time together, like when we hung out and friends.
The Dave Navarro section of the book is probably one of my favorite parts, actually.
Yeah, he was fun. We had a lot of fun together, and he's very witty and very smart and very fun to be around. And, you know, I haven't also hung out or talked to him in a long time, but he was a very, very fun, cool person to be around.
Well, so you know, you've been through highs and lows with Janie and Tommy Lee. Did they change over time? Did you ever make reconciliation with a lot of these guys? I mean, I know I've read the book, but maybe for my listeners, you can tease that out a little bit.
Yeah, Tommy and I, we didn't speak for a very long time. He ended up really being, you know, the one who broke my heart the most, and for what he did and how he did it. It took a very long time to heal from that. He eventually came around and apologized many, many years later. And I needed that because I did a lot of self-harm to, you know, over the pain of feeling that heartbreak. So, you know, we had rekindled our friendship and whatnot, and, you know, would talk and then lose touch and talk and lose touch. But we're not on bad terms right now. But I mean, maybe after he hears my podcast talking about the dirt, he may not be happy about it. He wasn't happy when this book came out. But we've talked since then, and, you know, via email a few times, and we were fine. But I mean, who's to say? He probably talks shit about me behind my back, but he always, if I were to reach out to him tomorrow, he would probably reply. He always has, but we're not really in each other's lives anymore, you know?
Well, it sounded like once you really spelled it out for him all those years later, he sort of has this epiphany where he's like, I didn't mean to hurt you that bad, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, when you're only thinking of yourself, you don't really consider the feelings of other people. And that's basically what he did. You know, he, you know, saw something else sparkly and shiny and thought he wanted to, you know, jump to the next thing and we weren't going to get back together. So he just dove right into it. But, he, you know, my feelings were never considered, but he wasn't thinking about me. He was thinking about himself. So, you know.
Well, you know, starting to maybe wrap up in the next, in the next few minutes, I just had a few more questions if you have the time.
Sure.
I had to ask, you got into acting, and I have to say, you're most known to me, for being in, The Great Married with Children. What was that sort of, like? How did you, end up on Married with Children, with the Bundys? Three times, actually.
Yeah, same with, you know, the auditions for the rock videos. Like, it was just an audition that would come in. They were looking for this type of girl or this look, and, you know, he had a lot of those dream girl sequences in that show. So I would audition for the part, and then after auditioning for the first part, they called me back, you know, after, because they liked working with me, and I did the other two episodes. So that's how that went. But basically, it was always just a call, you know, a casting call, and then an audition process.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the thing I see in both the Cherry Pie video and your appearances on Married with Children, I've actually said to people, I'm like, she has really great comic timing. And people just sort of look at me because I think they're like, oh, she's so pretty. She's so beautiful, which is true. But I think you also have a lot to offer comically. Maybe you could talk a little bit about working sort of comedically in those videos and what you're doing now comically.
Right. Well, I've always been a goofy, funny, joke cracking, sarcastic person in my life, you know, and people have always told me that I was very funny and that I should do comedy. And I auditioned for The Groundlings in my 20s, and I got into the second level with my audition. And I was dating a rock star at the time who told me I wasn't funny. So I quit like an idiot. So years later, and that's what I'll be discussing in my new book coming out on July 9th, called Cherry on Top, is, you know, the epiphany, what it took for me to have the epiphany to go back and do the one thing that I feared doing the most, the one thing that I really wanted to do and quit, was comedy. And the thing that happened that made me, you know, decide to go back into it. And so I've been doing it for about five or six months now. And, you know, I've already headlined, I'm touring a little bit, and I perform at the Comedy Store, monthly now, and in other venues in town and around the country. And, it's going actually really, really well, believe it or not. I don't know that I'm loving it per se, but I'm hoping that it will lead to other things and, get to do comedy and maybe TV or movies, or just continue just doing it in general, because it's just been an outlet for me to not go dark and like have one of those moments where it's like, what am I doing with my life kind of thing? Because, you know, I'm single, I'm not dating, I'm going to be 50 this year. And I was like, what the hell do I do with my life? So I just decided to do the one thing that scared the shit out of me as kind of like a bucket list thing. And I did, I'm doing it.
I'm actually surprised that that scares you, because like I said, looking at the cherry pie video, just the timing of your facial expressions and sort of how you play the character, it's just, there's a perfect comic timing to it. Maybe you could talk about sort of how you approach comedy and what goes into it.
Well, that's a totally different kind of being or doing comedy than stand up. Stand up is a whole nother ball of wax, and it's terrifying. It's one thing to be funny all day long, but a thing to make people laugh. You know what I mean? And it is terrifying. Every single time before I go up there, it's terrifying. I just, you know, there, a couple of times I even blacked out and didn't even remember doing it, out of fear. I don't do that anymore, but, it's a very scary experience, and it just depends on the audience. Sometimes you do great. Sometimes you don't have a great crowd. It depends on the crowd and the time that you go up, and, you know, it just all depends on whether you're on that night or you're not. Like, you know, so many variables go into whether you have a good show or not. So it's always hit or miss. But I really just think that if you just go up and have a good time and don't give a shit is when things go the best.
What does your material sort of deal with in your stand-up? Is it sort of autobiographical?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, so many people think that I should do that. But I'm always like, how is that funny? You know, but everybody's like, oh, she totally do like a Dirty Rocker Boys tour. I'm like, I don't know. So I just basically talk about what I'm dealing with, which is being single and 50 in Los Angeles, and what the internet and online dating has turned into finding a partner, because I find that so weird and such a different way of doing things. You know, I didn't grow up meeting people that way. And so it tends to lead to a very funny, you know, conversation or stand-up routine because of how crazy it is to be trying to meet people that way, and how people think and what they think of you and what they say and what their intentions are. And it's crazy.
Yeah. I assume you could have tons of material on, you know, instead of kids say the darndest things, guys say the darndest things.
That is pretty much 50% of what my routine is about. Yes. Yes.
Any particular, bad pickup lines you've heard?
Oh my God. So many. Like, that's part of my routine. I mean, I have guys just immediately, you know, they'll either go into trying to have sex with you, or they become like an Uber fan. Like, if they realize who I am, and then they're like, they go out, they become overzealous and weird, and possessive, and like too much on it, you know, like just so obsessive that it's like scary. And then it just varies. It's really weird. Or I'll just get the complete loser who for some reason thinks that I would go out with them. Or I've even been on dates and the guy was totally gay. Whoa. and like 5 feet tall. And I was like, and, you know, asking me about my skin regimen, and like, you know, it was just fucking weird. Just so weird. So you never know what you're getting. You know, because people lie. I mean, even guys lie about their age and put old pictures up, or it's kind of bizarre, you know?
Well, it's weird because, you know, a lot of people say women are like emotional and men are logical. But whenever I see a breakup, the guy can be extremely clingy and emotional on a level that I've never seen with women I know. Guys can be the biggest queens.
Oh, yeah. There's, you know, I really find that a turnoff, I have to say. But yes, I've seen it.
Well, you know, on a more serious note, I was curious, because there's a very small section of the book that's pretty explosive. I let readers look at it, but it sort of seems relevant in the age of Harvey Weinstein and documentaries like An Open Secret, the accusations that people like Corey Feldman have made. What do you think of sort of the sex scandals of Hollywood and sort of the abuse claims that go on? Do you think it's blown out of proportion? Do you think there's a lot that has been covered up? What is your take on that, if you're comfortable expressing it?
Yeah, it is very much who you fuck in this town to get ahead. And I just never wanted the part that bad. You know what I mean? But it is alive and well, and it has been going on for years. And every time you hear somebody say that they were molested or blah, 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 totally believe them, because that's what this entertainment industry is all about. And anybody who's famous has had to, sell a part of their self in ways that, you probably wouldn't ever want to do or imagine to get that famous. And, I just I never cared about it that much. So it's like, yeah, it's definitely a thing. And I don't know that it's getting blown out of proportion. I just feel like women are probably finally being heard or believed. And that's why it got so big, because somebody said something finally, and then everybody else was me too, and that's where that came from.
Well, I mean, I think it's a good thing, to be honest, the Me Too movement. I think men are having to rethink how they treat women. Women are being more honest about, this is my body and I have autonomy over it. And I think we're moving in a good direction.
I agree with you 100%.
I guess wrapping up, there were just two more things I wanted to mention. I know you have the podcast out with Charisse. You mentioned it earlier, but real quick, because all my listeners have been asking, what is your take on The Dirt? Maybe just a brief summary so we can sort of tease listeners into checking out your podcast.
Oh, I feel like it was very, very loosely based on truth, and the timeline was off. A lot of it was untrue. I mean, and yeah, the debauchery part was on there, but I just feel like they kind of pick and chose different scenes to, affect the watcher. And we know those guys for real and in real life. And there's a lot of the story that I was like, that's bullshit. It was just, I didn't love it. I thought it was bullshit. A lot of it was bullshit, basically. And in the podcast, I imitate Vince's singing, and me and Charisse go down the line of talking about what we thought about it and what really happened, what was true, and all this stuff, and how she felt about them, portraying something about her, something so serious about the death of her daughter, without even consulting her. Stuff like that. Like we pretty much, for the last two episodes of Bobby and Cherie's podcast, we pretty much ripped them a new one, basically.
Well, were you even in it as a character?
No, like, I was completely excluded from the story. But I was dating Tommy when they have John Karabi replace Vince.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm more sympathetic to your portrait. And that may be my own bias, because like, I just do not understand. I've never been into the whole cock rocker thing. To me, like, they're the guys that want to be rebellious, but only in as so much as they want to have long hair and wear makeup, but they sort of have the same mentality about women and other social issues as their dads.
Right, exactly. I agree with you on that. Totally.
Well, I guess wrapping up, I always tell my listeners that I like to end on a positive note. I think there is a lot of glimmers of hope in the end of the book, when it comes to things like family and sort of pushing out feelings of numbness by having closeness with family and friends. What would you say that we could end on a positive note with? Maybe you can elaborate on your feelings on how you've sort of come out the other side of the Sunset Strip machine.
Yeah, basically you just got to prioritize, you know, the people that love you and that are there for you no matter what, and that that it's not, you know, it's not about your career and fame and all this stuff. It's about who's been there for you and who would be there for you in the future if something were to happen. Like, you know, at the end of the day, like, that's all you really have is who you love and who loves you. And, you know, this career or this town isn't going to hold your hand at a hospital bed, or, you know what I mean? Like, you know, your animals and your friends and your family, it's really all we have.
Well, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views, Bobby Brown. Real quick, if you want to plug anything, I know you have a new book coming out in July.
Yeah.
Maybe tell my listeners about what you got in the works.
Yeah, I have a new book out coming out July 9th called Cherry on Top. And I'll be doing some festivals in town. I'll still be doing stand-up at the Comedy Store all the time. I have my podcast. I have my online vintage stores, BobbyJeanBrown.net and on Tradesy. That's pretty much all I have. Oh, I'm doing a movie. I have lots of stuff going on. You can follow me at Brown Bobby on Instagram or at Bobby Jean Brown on Twitter. And that's pretty much it. That's all I can think of right now.
Are we going to have maybe, the Dirty Rocker Boys, mini series at some point? And who would play
that.
Bobby Brown in it?
I have no idea, but I would absolutely love that because I think it would be such a great story.
Well, I heartily agree with that. I want to thank you again, Bobby Brown, for coming on Parallax Views.
Oh, you're so welcome, honey. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with the sweet as cherry pie, Bobby Brown. Check out her upcoming book, out in July, Cherry on Top. A sequel of sorts to her explosive tell-all must-read memoir, Dirty Rocker Boys, Love and Lust on the Sunset Strip. Got some news for those of you who are subscribing to Patreon. Have an episode coming out in the next day or so with Samira Khan, a journalist who's been exposing the Hindu nationalist ties of presidential candidate Tulsi Gabbard. It will be one you won't want to miss as we discuss not only Tulsi's problematic connections, but also the crimes of a fascist variant within the Hindu faith over the decades, and especially in Kashmir. It's an exclusive interview that you're not going to want to miss. So if you're feeling generous, be sure to contribute to the Parallax Views Patreon effort. And if you've been enjoying the episodes we've been putting out on the main feed, well, remember to like, share, subscribe, retweet, get the word out there about Parallax Views. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.